Good morning. I'd like to welcome you to 8 o'clock session, 8:05 session to be precise. It is a demonstration session with the Mobile Performance Group, and the title is Teaching Advanced Musical Concepts Through Multimedia Performance. It's presented by Dr. Nathan Wolak from Stetson University. Nathan is an audio artist and researcher whose work encompasses multimedia performances, interactive installations, and signal processing techniques. He has performed as a laptop musician in Canada, Brazil, and throughout the United States. His software developments include the Granular Toolkit for Max MSP and Hypno, a collection of over 40 plugins co-developed with ElectroTap. He's an assistant professor of music and program director of the Digital Arts Program at Stetson University. He completed his PhD at Northwestern University and, of course, currently resides in Florida. I'd like you to join me in welcoming Nathan Morton. Thank
you. Well, if you want to come down closer, basically, instead of everybody being in the back of the room. Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity to come out here from CMS and talk a little bit about what we've been doing with Mobile Performance Group. I'm going to be a little off my game here because my laptop's this way for performance purposes. So if I'm turning my back on you, don't take it as a sign of rudeness. But good introduction there, basically in terms of who I am. But I want to talk a little bit more about Mobile Performance Group and where the history of this group is. What our aesthetic motivations are, and as well as how we structure our performances and what kind of learning opportunities that gives our students, basically. That's the gist of what I wanted to talk about this morning. Mobile Performance Group is a part of our digital arts program. It's an ensemble that we use for both the video students and the audio students to perform together and stage multimedia performances. We did a little demonstration last night, so I don't know if everybody was able to see a little bit about what. We're going to do a little bit of performing of some of the material we did last night just to kind of demonstrate, and we can maybe talk through a little bit about what's going on with the various laptop computers that you see up here in the different controllers and the shopping carts and that sort of thing. But I want to talk through kind of a procedure of how we undertake one of these performances as well as part of my talk this morning. So we were founded in 2004. Matt Roberts, who was unable to be here this morning, but he's the one who founded the group. I was actually at a visiting lecturer at Stetson at the time, and he asked me to come on board as the music director, taking care of the musical end of things. Working with the music students and doing these performances. I think our first performance was actually down in Ybor City, down in Tampa, doing a performance there as part of the Ybor Festival of Moving Image that happens down there. Matt was adamant that we structure it as kind of a collective rather than an ensemble. And I bought into this idea early on, and I think it's paid off a lot of dividends. The key difference in that is that it's not an ensemble where we get together and we pass out the music and everybody practices their part and then we come back together and we perform. It's really a collective where each individual is working on their own component. It's part of the system. And then you bring it back to the whole. And the performance in itself is more structured more like a collective improvisation rather than a kind of set of through-composed piece of music, basically. Okay, we have several enabling technologies that we work with. Obviously, the performance would not be possible without laptop computers. These things are getting more and more portable all the time. Being able to pick up and take your instrument with you, and I do talk about the laptop as being a musical instrument. I believe that it's kind of come into its own here in the last decade or two, basically, as a legitimate instrument. As evidence, one of the other research topics that I've done, I just did a presentation recently talking about the references to laptop computers in the media. And it's interesting that if you read the New York Times, they refer to the laptop as an instrument in the same breath as oboes and cellos. And for them, it's not even an issue. So there's still some people that maybe were kind of educating in that process, but there's quite a bit of acceptance there of the fact that the laptop has come into its own. I've heard some people, even in the discipline, though, that are kind of like, no, it's not a true instrument. There's other things that you need, basically, in order to call it an instrument. But that's not the topic of debate for this morning. The other enabling technology are really these capturing devices. I'm using one here to record my talk. You can't see it because the chair's turned around, but I've got a Marantz portable digital audio recorder, and that was really one of the things that revolutionized what we were doing. The original performance in 2004, when we did our collection, it was me with a laptop and an audio interface working with another student trying to record everything. And it was a year later that these Marantz portable digital recorders started coming out, and then you started seeing them with other manufacturers as well. That really has revolutionized the process, being able to have a handheld battery-powered device going out and collecting sound is truly remarkable. And we've seen the same progression in the video in that time as well. We also, as part of our aesthetic, emphasize non-traditional venues. That's one of the reasons why it was important for me when we were setting up this conference presentation, that rather than doing a performance for you in a rehearsal hall like this at 8 a.m. in the morning, we were actually outside in our natural environment. We like performing outdoors. We like using non-traditional venues. It's nice to encounter the uninitiated audience member, people that have never seen an electronic music performance or a multimedia performance, and you don't get that in these kind of cloistered halls where everybody's has an invited guest list, basically, and it's all the people that are in the know, basically. It's amazing the interactions you have with people when you're doing something, you know, quasi, we were joking last night, quasi-magical, basically, when you've wired up a shopping cart for performance, basically. And those kind of interactions just don't happen in your traditional concert hall. Our guiding aesthetics, one of the things that came on board rather early on is this idea of psychogeography, and it's an artistic movement that goes back to the mid-20th century. This idea that you can explore a place through art, okay? That's a key part of our aesthetic. The other thing is, the second is going to be mobile presentation, being able to be on the move and out and about in the community, being able to move, and I'll demonstrate a little bit of that as I go through my talk this morning. And then also co-opting technologies. We're not using anything that you couldn't buy for yourself in a kind of your maybe not consumer electronics store, but basically, you know, specialty shops. Basically, it's not any special technology that we're using. Part of that is form following function. We're a digital arts program at a small liberal arts college. We don't have an engineering program where we can design these great new controllers, basically, with our engineering students. So part of that is working with off-the-shelf technology that we can kind of repurpose and reuse. But it also is a good opportunity for our students to kind of think about what they can do with the tools beyond maybe what the manufacturer had intended in their design. Learning opportunities, there's quite a bit of learning going on here as the students work through this, through staging a performance. There's a practical application of techniques. So the stuff that they're learning in their computer music classes on the audio side of things, synthesis techniques, processing techniques, algorithmic composition techniques, they start to use that really quickly when we get to doing this this ensemble. And I was actually talking to these guys this year. I think next year I'm actually going to, in my computer music class, hand out the tools that we use in MPG like the first week. That's something I haven't tried before. I usually am taking baby steps with them, kind of walking them through Max MSP. But I'm interested to maybe next year to try out giving out the MPG toolkit that we use the first week and have people build instruments for the system right off the bat. I think that might give them a little bit more of a kind of a goal-directed learning so they can see where the end result is. Working in a collaborative setting, obviously working with other musicians is something that we do all the time as musical performers, as people that are, have advanced musical training. But while working with video performers, video performance is an newish discipline, especially when compared to musical performance, right? I mean, we have hundreds of years of history with musical performance. Video performance, you're looking at maybe three decades of history. And working out what that means, because we, especially as musicians, we come with all kinds of baggage as far as what a preparation for a performance is supposed to look like. Video performers have a different set of baggage. It's probably not as heavy as our baggage. You know, instead of it being like a five-piece luggage set, you know, they've got a little handbag that they bring with them, basically. And that's not anything against them, basically, but they just, we have hundreds of years of history. They have three decades. And so it's still very new to them to be performing. In fact, there's people in the discipline of video that are just kind of, tangentially aware that video can actually be used as a performance medium, not just as something that you use for creating fixed media, basically. In music, we've been kind of the other way. We've been a performance medium for, however many hundreds of years, and we've kind of in the last 100 years come to it being as a fixed medium, basically. And what does that mean? And then also professional presentation of work. We do occasional performances on campus, but the majority of our performances are actually at conferences like this and festivals around the country. We've traveled to San Jose, to San Diego, to Brooklyn, to New Orleans, all through kind of sending our proposal as far as what we do and sending them a short video clip of encapsulating what it is we do for a performance. And we've gotten invites all over the country, and the deans are all too eager to send us out and represent the school at these various conferences. And they love the fact that, especially being at a liberal arts college where it's undergraduate only, our program, so they're very excited to get our students out there, get them exposed to what the wider professional world is doing. It gets them beyond the confines of little old DeLand. Yes. Not that we, it's home, but it's also, there's not exactly a burgeoning experimental art scene outside of the digital arts department, basically.
There are some people. I don't want to cut some short, basically. But
in terms of staging a performance, it really breaks down into three phases, okay? Phase one is collection, going out and gathering sounds, going out and gathering images. And in order to do that, we have to put together pieces of gear. This is a picture of Jason, who graduated a few years ago while we were in San Jose. This is him using the Marantz. He's got his boom arm with a microphone attached to it. He's got his headphones, and he's completely mobile at this point. Everything's battery powered. He's got a backup set of batteries that he can use in case those batteries run out. And basically, with the gear that he has on him, he can be out for a good 3-4 hours, if not longer. Usually the students get tired before the equipment gets tired, basically. And the digital recorders, because they use compact flash cards, you can get cards up to like 4 or 8 gigabytes now, basically. So in terms of recording CD quality sound, that's a lot of sound you can capture, okay? Similar thing going on the video side. This is Esther, who also graduated a few years ago. Video, we've seen a little bit more evolution here recently. When we were first working out the first couple of years in performance, we were actually using DV cameras, which are pretty fast in terms of capturing the footage, and then you have to import the footage onto the hard drive, and then you can edit it up into digital clips. But it was actually a slower process for them because of the capture process, the process of taking the video and importing it to the computer. If you record 2 hours of video footage, it actually takes 2 hours to get it onto the computer, okay? We didn't have that problem with these Marantz recorders because it's all on a compact flash drive. You just connect it to your USB port, and boom, it's on the computer. Just this performance, we purchased these new little flip video. I don't know if you've seen these, basically. They work somewhat on the same principle as these Marantz and these digital audio recorders, whereby they record to an SD card or a compact flash card, and then they have a little switch on them. I wish I had one of them with me. Should ask them to leave one, but there's a little switch on the side and actually a little USB thing pops out on the side, and you connect it and you've immediately got access to the SD card and all the digital video footage. They're meant to be for recording YouTube clips, basically. So it's interesting to see as this social networking and Web 2.0 stuff starts to penetrate our society, the tools that are developed to come alongside that and support that part of our kind of our culture. But it's an amazing little device. It brings them up to speed in terms of the capture process with the audio guys, because they can just pop out the little USB connection, plug it in the computer, and they've got all their clips, basically, that are recorded for the day. It has like a 2 gig, you can get various sizes, but I think that they top out at like 60 minutes or 100 minutes of video, and it's pretty good quality. I mean, it's compressed, but it's the same compression scheme that our software needs to use, so... It was a no-brainer for us to add that to our arsenal, basically. other ways of recording, not just with traditional microphones, but also contact microphones. Lots of good sounds you can get with contact microphones. Everybody familiar with? Okay. And this brings me to, I mean, one of the things that going out and collecting we want to encourage in our students is actually getting them to kind of think beyond just the sounds that they're hearing and see potential in objects that they encounter. Okay. I actually talk about this in my DA 101 class, the intro class that I teach, because they do an assignment where we send them out to collect sounds basically around campus using these same Marantz recorders. But talking to them about the fact that don't just listen to the sounds that are there. Observe objects that maybe if you connected a contact microphone to them or you set up your microphone and you were to hit that object or you were to rub that object or you were to, I don't know, whatever other action you want to perform on that object, basically, just like a musical instrument, right? A violin doesn't make any noise on its own when it's just sitting there. You have to actually actuate it. You have to have some sort of physical input of energy. And so getting them to think about objects in the world around them in that way is an important part of what we do as just as electronic music composers, basically, you know, discovering sound that's out there in the world that we can use in performance. And so that's a big part of what they're able to learn. So kind of summarizing the learning objectives in this phase one, managing field equipment, obviously walking around with a bunch of gear, you know, it's something that you kind of have to learn to juggle, right? Okay. And we give them not much instruction, basically. We just give you, here's the gear, go figure out how to do it, okay? Which, in itself, the process of them figuring it out, you know, studies show in terms of pedagogy that the stuff that we say as professors goes usually in one ear and out the other and is forgotten by the time they walk out the door, basically. So giving them the gear, giving them something hands-on that they're not going to tell, you know, you're not going to break this, okay? Take this, here's a microphone, point it at things, figure out how it works, basically. And they, by the time they're done with an afternoon of recording with this stuff, they know how to use it, and they have a pretty good strategy kind of internally worked out on how to use this, and they can then also teach other students how to use it, and it kind of, the learning kind of propagates from there. Also, as I already mentioned, imagining and evaluating potential in objects, that's an important skill to have, seeing the potential for sound in the world outside of, you know, the studio, basically. And then also interacting with the public. You'd be, a lot of people, you know, you're walking around with a bunch of gear hanging off of you, people have questions, obviously, okay? Especially, no one's ever gotten any kind of belligerent or anything with us. I've always been kind of scared in a post-9/11 world that someone might get the wrong idea as far as what we're doing. But we never had any kind of interaction on that regard. People are just kind of naturally curious, like, you know, what are you doing out here? You know, that sort of thing. People in all kinds of strange places, too, recognizing pieces of gear. In San Jose, one of the oddest things was a guy just walked up to one of the students and was like, I see you have a contact microphone there. What are you doing with that? Basically, it's not, you don't expect people out in public to recognize what a contact microphone is, what it's used for, and the fact that we're taping it to the side of things and listening, you know, to what's going on in the world around us. It gets them to think on their feet and be able to verbalize what it is they do. I mean, one of the constant topics of conversation with my students is explaining what we do to other people, basically. Usually it's in the form of talking to their parents, basically, trying to explain why it is they're majoring in this thing and what it is they're hoping to get out of it. The thing I always tell them is I'm still trying to explain to my parents what I do, so it's a lifelong process. Phase two is organization. We gather all this material, we bring it back together. Usually when we're doing this, we're actually, when we've traveled around the country, this is usually a kind of a multi-day process, so we'll plan like 4 days at a location to do this. So day one will be gathering, day two will be organization, and I should have mentioned during part of the gathering process is talking to locals about where might we go to get sound, basically, and you'd be surprised how people kind of think about that and interacting with them, accessing their kind of aural memories of locations. We've gotten a few good locations out of that. I think when we were in San Diego, there was a beach that was recommended to us that was like a hot spot that we would have never found on our own. You have to kind of talk to the locals for that kind of stuff. But organization, when you bring this stuff in, you get, you know, obviously hundreds of WAV files that you have to go through and look down. So this is actually a screenshot of our collection here from UCF. So the performance that we did last night, some of the performance we're doing here, we actually came on February 11th, since we're so close. We came a few weeks ahead of time, basically. I recorded a bunch of sounds around campus. And then we divvied it up, basically. organized with these guys here. I've got my name up there too, so I took on part of the workload as well. And you're looking at, you know, several minutes of sound here, and what are the relevant parts? What are the parts that you're going to use? What are the parts that you're just going to, you know, put in the archive bin, basically? And so you need to kind of figure out, okay, that sound looks interesting there. Let me edit it down. Let me crop it so that it's a usable sample, okay? And so they get really good at this editing process, okay? They've got potentially hours of footage to get through, basically, to find out where the usable bits are. So they have to listen, evaluate. Maybe the noise is too loud on this one, so I can't use it. The noise reduction works okay on this one, so I can use this one. This one, oh, this is really clean because I was using the contact microphone, kind of, you know, thinking through all the decisions that they made at recording time. And it's interesting, after they've gone through the editing process, it changes what they do in the recording process, because they kind of they realize after the fact, oh, you know, if I'd done this, this, and this, I might have gotten a better recording to deal with on the other side, basically. But editing it down, cropping it so that it's a nice, usable sample, and then producing clusters of things. And these are kind of categories that we've been using for a few years that have worked for us in performance. There's kind of ambient sounds that are just kind of location recordings, people talking, also resonances. You'd be surprised, you can find all kinds of pipes and tubes and that sort of stuff. You just stick your microphone in there and just let it hum, basically. You get these wonderful pitches that work really well in performance. Events are kind of one-time sounds, sounds you might want to use once or twice in performance. Then there are percussion samples, which relatively, I mean, none of it is actually percussion instruments, but they're things that we've been, we're out and about kind of hitting on, and hey, that sounds like a kick drum, I could use that. Boom, boom, okay, good. That sounds cymbal-ish, you know. We organize that a little bit further in terms of pitch and pitched and unpitched, and we can use actually analysis software to figure out like what the pitch content looks like and kind of tag it for, okay, it's the C-sharp's really strong in this one, so maybe you want to use that in a key where we're actually C-sharp is present, you know, not maybe not C major, but, you know, D major would work, you know, that's what we would give a nice leading tone. Speech, so speech samples, people talking. One of the favorites, actually, we didn't get a recording of this time, but one of the favorites speech samples is getting people to say MPG for life. So we have several recordings from across the country of people, various people from all walks of life saying that, but we'll use sometimes in performance. Should have done that anyway. And then I bet you, sense cycles. I think I'm the only one that uses that category. I actually, in order to be aesthetically pure and use all of them, all material from the location, my synthesizers actually use cycles of the waveform from sounds that we've captured as wavetables. And so I'm not using, I mean, I have, sometimes I'll throw in a sine wave generator or those sorts of things, but the majority of the time, my synthesizers are actually based on wavetables that I've lifted from sounds we've recorded. So even my synthesized timbres are actually from the location. And you get some interesting synthesizer timbres that way, basically, just zooming really far in on the waveform and grabbing one cycle and then spinning it over and over again. So learning outcomes from this, obviously streamlining the editing procedure, getting used to this, doing it very rapidly, because we usually do this if we have a day, that's great. Sometimes we have to like capture during the day and then edit all evening and then go out and capture again and edit all evening, basically. So they get really good at this process. We had a little bit more time this time because we came and captured a few weeks ahead of time because of the proximity. Abstracting the sound from the physical objects, learning to divorce the two, because what produced the sound is not necessarily what the sound is good for in performance. And then also coming up with good descriptors for these sounds. I think they learn pretty quickly, and this is maybe nothing that I like literally tell them, basically, but they learn pretty quickly that if you label everything metallic hit, metallic hit 2, metallic hit 3, how do you tell the difference between those in performance? Because usually you're making pretty quick decisions in performance about which sounds to use and that sort of thing. Phase 3, presentation. How we do this, and we've got a little bit of our setup here for to show you, but where we started out actually using automobiles rather than shopping carts. And you can see here, what we would do inside, this is actually Matt's car, the audio and video performance would be seated inside the automobile, okay? We would take the mixer and actually use, we both have a tape deck in our car, so you have those tape to iPod converters, basically. Works just as well if you plug that into a mixer. And then you plug all your laptops into the mixer, and you've all of a sudden got a mobile sound system that you can drive around all over the place. And so when we were performing in Ybor City, we did a performance like this in Orlando, just driving around downtown playing. It's interesting, though, in the interactions for people, though, because the sound system, they just kind of discount as being, oh, that's just another loud car. But then they turn around and look at it and like, well, what's this guy doing playing his sound system that loud? But the projected image on the rear windshield usually gets people's attention in this case, basically, because they're this is actually the projector aimed at the rear windshield. And what Matt figured out is that if you take hairspray, it creates a nice screen, basically, that will hold the image. And so driving down around through the downtown area with a with an actual projection, the concern there is that you're going to get pulled over by a cop or something and be told that you're a distraction to other drivers, but that's yet to happen. We've actually had a few cops tail us just watching the image, seeing what's going on, basically. So I don't know if that says something about your police department here in Orlando or whatever, but yeah, they seem to be more interested in, like, what is this group doing, basically. So that was kind of how we started out. We kind of migrated outside the automobile. This is a performance we did in Gainesville, where we actually parked the car and we invited people to see. We've got our video performers in the front seat, but the back seat was open so that people could get inside. And we actually used those little kiddie DVD displays that you put on the back of the seat. We were actually projecting on those, our video images, as well as projecting out underneath this alcove, basically. The rest of us audio performers set up on the hood, and we performed into the sound system, and it basically became like a little kind of mobile theater that people could, you know, just like your kids sit in the back seat kind of watching DVDs. Well, we imagine kind of a kid sitting in the back seat watching experimental multimedia performance. Why not, you know? So it was a fun time, and it took a little bit of coaxing to get people. No, the performance is actually inside the car. It's a little bit reminiscent of a, was it Parade, right? The come and see the sideshow, that sort of thing. Then we kind of migrated to shopping carts for mobility's sake. And this is kind of a screenshot of our early mock-up for the shopping cart performance. We would sometimes use this in conjunction with inflatable screens. This is actually a plastic sheet, and if you use an iron, you can iron it into kind of an inflatable bubble. Like plastic sheeting that we'd use for wrapping packages and that sort of stuff. And the iron actually melts it together and you can create these various shapes. You hook it up to a desktop fan, basically, and you've got an inflatable screen. It's translucent enough that it holds the image, and the nice thing is that you can view it from 360 degrees all the way around. So there's no obstructed views or anything as far as getting everybody oriented for the actual performance. Let's see. Just to show you here. So the nice thing about the shopping carts, everything kind of breaks down. So we're using these rods across here. These are actually they're the things that you attach to the wall to hang shelves off of, like in your garage. So using a couple of those, stringing in between the carts, and then these are actually recycled cardboard that's been glued together into big, thick pieces. And when you detach things, you can just throw all the gear in the shopping cart and wander the city, basically. San Jose was actually pretty great. They gave us kind of carte blanche to go wherever we wanted around downtown because there was a multimedia festival going on at the time. And so there were all kinds of stranger things than us, basically, going on across the city. Noise ordinances usually become a little bit of a problem, basically. We have to kind of scope out what the noise ordinances are before we start doing it. I think when we performed in Brooklyn, the festival organizers were very adamant. It was like, no, you must stay here. You cannot go anywhere. You're performing here in front of this venue. This is where we have permission for you to make noise. So we try to respect the laws where we can, basically. And acquiring proper sound permits when we need to, and that sort of thing. And we had to do that in San Diego as well. Even though we were on a college campus, they still wanted us to have a sound permit and everything. But being mobile is kind of the true motivation of the group and what we want to be able to do. And the shopping carts are actually pretty good for that. It was interesting also in San Jose encountering some of the homeless population who had their own shopping carts with their, you know, entire worldly possessions, and they're interested to kind of interact with, like, what do you have in your shopping cart? You know, that sort of thing. But, you know, and they were just as interested in what we were doing. That's part of that, going back to what I was saying about meeting the uninitiated audience member, basically. You don't find those people in the concert hall in academia, basically, at invited conferences. Nothing against those types of things, because, you know, I'm an academic, too. I make my living going and doing these sorts of things. But it's always interesting to meet those people that you wouldn't encounter otherwise in rooms like these.
Okay.
You guys saw us performing last night, so this is just a screenshot of us in performance. A lot of our chiropractic bills tend to be a little high, basically, as we're always hunched over, kind of bending. Maybe we need to get something a little taller than shopping carts next time. But you can see us all kind of spread out here, performing in front of a location. Similar thing here from San Diego, kind of more condensed setup. This is two shopping carts that we have up here. So learning outcomes from performing, obviously improving their improv sensibilities, and it's a different kind of performance than when you're taking care of things on a note-by-note basis. Most of these instruments work on an algorithmic level, so the students are more concerned with listening to layers, and adding layers and bringing layers out, and those sort of, that sort of listening. So it's a more, I guess, orchestration kind of listening rather than on a note-by-note basis. Testing and improving the instrument design. Nothing brings out the flaws in your programming than actually trying to get up in front of people and run the thing. As someone who's had computer crashes happen, we've hopefully designed the system robust enough that it can actually survive any one of our computers crashing and the performance can keep going. And then again, interacting with the public. Last night I was everybody was kind of standing back, like, come on up and ask questions. And usually people are right up in your face and you want... You almost want them to back off. We've kind of gotten used to that at this point. Getting the students to kind of talk with people, answer their questions, and that getting them to think on their feet and describe what it is they do is an important part of the learning process. And then what I've appropriately I've called phase zero. So I mentioned three phases. The one that I left out is instrument design. The reason I left it out of the three phases is because it happens concurrently with all the other phases, before, during, and after. Working on your actual instrument for the laptop. I'll show you a little bit about our system that allows us to communicate with each other and share information. The musical data is all shared common across the network. And so what you've got three different colors here. Those are three different sections of this little kind of... it's not a plugin, but it's a patch that runs inside your patch in MaxMSP. MaxMSP Genesis, which is the software that we're using. And so it registers IP addresses from everybody as they log on to the network. We're actually using an Ethernet hub over here. The video card over there is actually connected. It's a wireless hub, so he's connected wirelessly. So usually some component is wireless so that it can roam a little bit. Wireless messes a little bit with the timing information of rhythmic stuff, but not so bad that we notice. And then, let's see. Next section, you've got pitch information, and this again propagates across the network. So I or anybody else, because they're each person's patch runs in either slave or master mode, so we can coordinate to say, okay, you take over as master on this one and call out different changes. A lot of what we do, though, we end up in kind of just running this from set to set, and it ends up being quasi-modal sounding, basically, as we kind of vamp in a tonic in a scale structure, basically. But the scale, the basis for the scale, and this is actually a very long menu with a lot of different scale options that I lifted out of a David Cope book, the Techniques for the Modern Composer. Yeah, I programmed all those scales in here so I can use those as the basis. And then it goes into the structure menu, and I can actually edit this, and if I want to delete members of the chord and add or a scale and add members of the chord, the scale, excuse me, I can do that there where it says struct. And then on top of that, you can define elements of the chord. So this is kind of a weighting mechanism. So you can have scale notes, and then you can have chord notes that are maybe weighted a little bit more heavily in your patch. And so what happens there, we've got, let's see, so the root is the zeroth scale degree, and then use the second and the fourth scale degree, so we actually get the tonic chord out of that information there. That then gets sent across the network, and the students have patches that then allow them to query positions within the scale. So the way I was explaining it to somebody, if you define your C major scale, C, D, E, F, G, A, B, C, okay, all the student has to do is say, well, I want the fourth item in the scale, because it starts counting at zero. So the fourth item in the scale, and it will spit out the MIDI information for them as far as which pitch they're supposed to be playing at that time. The beauty of this system is that they can design their patch so that it's agnostic in terms of what scale we're playing in, what key we're playing in. All they have to do is question what position in the scale do I want at any given time, basically. And it gives them it takes this scale and it propagates it over 10 octaves, basically, so they can always stay within the scale. And essentially, they don't have to redesign the patch just because we change key. It changes key and tonic information out from underneath them. And so they can design the patch once and it will continue to run. That speeds things up quite a bit, basically. And it also ensures that we all stay kind of harmonious. Now, of course, they can take that MIDI information if they decide, well, I'm going to always be two half steps high so that we have a bitonal feature. All they have to do is add 2 to the MIDI note number when it comes out, and they can do that, basically. But most of the time, we stay kind of relatively in the same key. Then below that, we have the tempo information, 120 BPM, and that actually, what that does, there's a little ramp. For those of you that are familiar with MaxMSP, we're using a phaser, okay? The phaser object actually ramps from 0 to 1 across what would be a 4-bar cycle. So there's a rhythmic cycle kind of inherent. Each computer has an independent phaser. What we found was sending out the frequency of that phaser and sending out when you should be at 0 is enough to keep all the computers in sync. In addition, because we're not using like MIDI time clock, because MIDI, if you're familiar with MIDI time clock, that's broadcast like 960 messages in a second, basically, or a beat. And if the master goes away, all of a sudden, all of the slaves are like, what happened, basically? They freak out, basically. Because each computer has its own independent phaser that's just being resynced every rhythmic cycle, if the master goes down, the slaves keep playing, okay? That's the other beauty of this system, basically. So it's built so that it can survive a crash of any of the computers on the network. Because if you've done any amount of performing with a laptop computer, you know that crashes inevitably will happen during performance.
Yes.
Okay. So we have to build the system to survive that. Okay. In addition, I've started giving them this patch. This is something that started as part of my performance patch, but I've started handing it out to the students now. This is what I call the Rhythm Bank. It allows, across the top, there's red lights that kind of move in sync with the rhythmic cycle. And then you can enter rhythmic patterns below that. There's a number of tools. There's the ticks at the top right now that are set to 16 and 4, so it ends up looking a lot like 4-4. But you can actually change those numbers to be any number, basically. So if you want to see what 3 and 5 ticks looks like, it fills them in. And then you can kind of move in sync with that and fill in your rhythmic pattern. There's actually some buttons that like auto-fill the rhythmic pattern for you on the side here. And then you can patch, the purple section over there patches out to the outlets going to your various synthesizers, okay? So they have a ready-made system for learning what key we're in and making sure they stay in communication with the key, and then also staying in the rhythmic pattern and building their own rhythmic patterns that work with the rhythmic cycle, okay? Beyond that, they have to build their own instruments. All this does is output clicks. Click, 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 okay? They have to build a synthesizer then that works with that, okay? This is maybe where I'll speed up a little bit here, because this is my synthesizer here, but each one of these students has built their own synthesizer. Then learning outcomes, they learn to manage the design cycle from idea to performance. They have to learn to adapt to a prescribed protocol. One of the things that I'm part of a professional organization now talking to employers, one of the things that the employers were talking about is, they notice in programming classes, a lot of times students work with the whole, they work on designing the whole thing themselves, and they never have to work with an outside library or an outside system that somebody else has defined for them. And so actually, it's an important learning exercise for them to say to a student, okay, this is the system. This is how it's going to work. You have to react to it. You can't change it, okay? We've made some tweaks to the protocol over time, basically, but having something pre-existing that they have to react to is an important programming skill to have. application of their stuff that they're learning in computer music class, and then also designing some expressive capabilities. This is maybe where we honestly could do a little bit more, basically, working with things like the Wiimotes, working with things with other types of controllers. Although I think that what we've done with the shopping part in the video performance is an example of what we can do with some of the expressive capabilities. And I'm looking at my watch, and I've got 10 more minutes, basically. Let's go ahead and fire up our performance system here, and maybe rather than playing for 10 minutes, we can just like get it started and then turn down the volume and maybe answer questions while it's running about how it works. Okay, I'm going to actually remove my video here and get to the video recorder here. Unless there are any questions right now, do you want to wait till like the sound's going first? And then, okay, you're fine either way. Let's see. You need that. Usually, it averages about 3 audio and 3 video. Right now, we've got 3 plus. David kind of moves in between the audio and video side.
That was my next question: is how much kind of interdisciplinary work do the audio folks start messing around with video stuff?
There's usually one or two that kind of move in between. But they, even though we're an interdisciplinary program with collaborative goals, people still tend to want to specialize. He's got to get his video projection working here.
Yeah, it crashed.
Oh, okay. As we said, crashes happen. Give us your name.
Do you introduce kind of a library of synth objects or objects that you use to create to build a patch of it?
I mean, beyond working with like what the tools are that are built into Max, I don't know. I don't think they go too much other than that. Oh, you got to turn off the mirroring, don't you? Oh, you should be. Yeah, you should go just run it. Yeah. Sorry, I'm just making sure this runs here. Reacting? Well, I think it's fine. I think it's fine for now if it has the dock and the title bar. Let's just make sure we can get it running here. Is everything working? Yeah. Okay. So. Sound.
Thank you.
Who's doing what? That's a good question. It kind of all kind of gets layered into the mix. If I could turn up.
Similar intro to like the Reebok base, and then we've got three dimensions as you move along.
And then Dave over there is.
Signal. I'm grabbing this contact right here, and as I touch the shopping cart, it increases the resistance of my body. So it's scaled to the more contact I have, the higher the dose for me. So I can kind of almost play. And it's also affecting the visual. This is the crossfade between the two different videos. Switched up here, which changed the video, changed stretching, turned on the stretching mechanism, which controls the wide stretch, and then also the inversion of the colors. And then this one rotates and does an X.
So yeah, one of the fun things last night was watching people, I mean, inviting people to come up and interact with the shopping cart and play with it. We had several people last night try it out. It takes a little bit to get kind of the hang of what the expressivity is, and it actually changes per person, right? You get to kind of calibrate it because of the different people have different body masses, so you have different capacitance in their body. Sort of a similar principle like how the theremin works, because there's a certain amount of electrical charge your body can hold, basically, and that determines how much resistance. So they found in testing that it was some people could make it play all. I think it's tuned to David right now, basically, because he can play all the different scale pieces. But then having it control both the audio and the visuals, and the rest of us kind of forming a collective bed of sound, basically, for that to work on top of, basically, as we invite people to. Because obviously, my max patch, if I ask people to come up here and play with it, I don't know if they'd be able to do that, basically. But this is something you can explain to someone in probably, 30 seconds to a minute, basically, and have them kind of making noise and performing along, basically, with the ensemble. It adds another layer to the performance. Being able to interact with people. Yeah.
You typically just have one video artist and then several audio artists? Or can you have you tried it with multiple?
Yeah, we've done multiple projections. Because most of the time we're running off of car batteries, or actually marine batteries, because they're bigger. What we find is the video projectors eat those things faster than everything else. That's kind of the bottleneck we're at right now, because they eat so much juice running the lamp inside the projector that we can only go for so much time with the video projectors. And if you're running two, it's just that much more juice.
What about multiple videos into one output, though?
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of doing that because he's got two parallel videos that he can crossfade between.
Right.
Yeah, like as I grab this, it switches in between.
We actually had two students in San Diego. One of them was running a cell phone patch, and people could text words to a SIM card that he bought, and they were showing up on the screen over the video that another student was doing.
So another way to interact with the audience, basically. So we had like little flyers that we printed up, basically. Here, text messages to this number. And you'd be surprised. I mean, most people, of course, the texting is pervasive now in the kind of college-age audience, basically. So you're handing out that on a college campus, we got all kinds of text messages that would pop up on screen and fly around, basically, as they were messing with them. So we have a lot of fun, but, I mean, there's a lot of technical stuff they learn along the way in terms of procedures and... just applying some of the stuff that they're learning in class in a performance setting. So I know we're out of time. So
yeah.
All right. Thank you.